Hello and welcome back to The Pisky Trap, a series where we explore the folklore, history and legends from across Devon and Cornwall. It's good to be back again. Hope you're all keeping well. Once again, a big thank you to all of you who've been listening to the series so far. Thank you for all your support. A particular shout out to all the lovely patrons who basically helped me to cover the running costs and make this series possible, really. And if you're new to the series and you've been enjoying it so far, then please give us a like and subscribe. Maybe spread the word among your friends, because that really helps too. If you'd like to help support the project further, enabling me to keep researching and pop more content out, then please check out my Patreon page at patreon.com/thepiskytrap. I have to say, I'm excited about this episode, because it's something slightly different. It's a topic that's always fascinated me, but has been on the back burner for a while whilst we've been looking at other things. And it was actually suggested in a chat with a person who's collaborated with me on this episode. It's been fun because it pushed me into a slightly different avenue of research. So we're going to dive straight in a sec. But as usual, I want to take a quick moment to give a little plug to another creative project. If, like me, you enjoy listening to podcasts, and you find yourself drawn to a series that's maybe geared towards history, true crime, elements of folklore, the supernatural and the unexplained, then I highly recommend checking out the Dark Histories podcast. The series has been going for a number of years now, and some of you may already have encountered it, I'm sure. But it was a recent discovery for me, and I got hooked quite quickly because there were a number of topics that piqued my interest. It ranges from true crime, witch trials, hauntings, unsolved mysteries, and the like. There's lots there. And I find it nicely presented and researched, so I highly recommend checking that out if you get chance. Right then, let's crack on with the episode. I want to return to a topic that we have explored once before, but that remains a real draw, and for me anyway, a source of inspiration, and that is the sea. Living in Cornwall, you're basically on one long peninsula. So you're pretty much surrounded by the sea. Where I live, on the south coast, I'm about a 15-20 minute walk from the beach. So I love taking a wander down there, and this year I got into sea swimming. Really enjoy that. But I know that for some of you, that can be quite a daunting prospect. It's one thing to go swimming in a swimming pool, but the ocean is a whole different matter. Whether it's not liking the thought of feeling out of your depth, or, and we've talked about this before, not knowing what's beneath you, that fear of the unknown, basically, and that idea that anything could be lurking just beneath the waves. I think this episode really taps into that. A while back, we explored the subject of mermaids, those beautiful creatures that crop up in legends from all across Cornwall and are a pretty universal theme in mythology. But today, I want to take a look at a topic that's, well, it's fascinated me even from when I was a young boy. And that is the idea of sea monsters. Giant sea creatures and sea serpents in particular. To my mind, there's something both terrifying and captivating about the idea that there could be these giant, mysterious creatures living beneath the waves. I love looking at those old medieval and Renaissance maps, with their weird and wonderful illustrations of strange, mythical beasts and coiled serpents that were said to inhabit the ocean. It brings to mind phrases like, "Here be monsters," that we still kind of throw around. Mythology, tales and stories surrounding monsters that dwell in rivers, lakes, and seas goes way back into antiquity. Famously, there's the Odyssey, attributed to Homer and thought to have been composed sometime between 750 and 700 BC. In Book 12, we're told of two creatures that inhabit the Straits of Messina. The Scylla, that snatched up and devoured sailors on passing ships, and the Charybdis, which would suck vessels down into the dark waters. In Norse mythology, there was the giant serpent Jormungand, or Jormungandir, who encircled the seas around Midgard, the world inhabited by humans. Then there's the Kraken, described in the Natural History of Norway in 1755 as a beast that is round, flat, and full of arms or branches, the largest and surprising of all human creation. And normally this is represented as a giant squid or octopus. Then in Celtic mythology, and particularly associated with Ireland and Scotland, is the Kelpie, a water spirit that's often depicted as a horse that's said to delight in drowning its victims. Of course, we can't mention Scotland without touching upon that most famous of creatures known as the Loch Ness Monster. There are said to be references to a creature living in the nearby River Ness in the life of St. Columba, dating to the 6th century. But it's really from the 19th and early 20th centuries that there are many descriptions of some kind of creature living in the loch. Normally depicted with a long neck and one or more humps. And it's those grainy early 20th century photos of so-called Nessie that stick in my mind as a boy of around 7 or 8, looking at those old books of monsters and the unexplained in the local library. It was some similarly grainy photos, dating from the 1970s, that I can remember seeing many years ago and being curious about, and being equally surprised to learn that they came from Cornwall, specifically the Falmouth Bay area, where over a number of years there seemed to have been sightings of a creature that was given the name Morgor or Morgar. So in this episode, we're going to be exploring the story surrounding Morgor and the alleged sightings, as well as looking at a number of other accounts and encounters with sea serpents and large, unexplained sea creatures from the seas around Cornwall over the past 200 years. Helping me to dive a bit deeper, pun thoroughly intended, into these legends, stories and sightings is the brilliant Elizabeth Dale, writer, blogger, podcaster, known to many as the Cornish Bird. We're going to be looking at some of these stories and asking what we can make of them and why they still continue to fascinate us. So, without further waffling from me, here's our next episode, Cornish Sea Monsters. In their book Folklore of Cornwall, Tony Dean and Tony Shaw write, "Even today, the world under the sea is comparatively unknown. It is quite understandable that stories of sea creatures exist all over the world. In Cornwall, belief in a huge octopus-like creature still lingers in the district around Gadrevy and Portreath on the north coast. Here, the seabed shelves steeply, and the old sailors explained the sudden depth as a monster's lair." Belief in strange, fantastical creatures that inhabit the seas has been around for centuries. From tales and legends of mermaids, which we've talked about in the past, to stories of giant squid and octopus, sea serpents and prehistoric creatures. In this episode, I want to take a look at some examples of sightings from over the centuries, focusing on the seas around Cornwall, but also looking at the wider context for the belief in these legendary creatures. I want to begin by looking at one of the earliest accounts that I've found, which dates from the first half of the 19th century. We'll talk about this in a bit more detail later, but for whatever reason, the 1800s seems to have seen a massive surge in accounts, sightings, and just a general interest in the phenomenon of sea serpents. Sightings and discussions on the subject seem to crop up fairly frequently in the papers. One example comes from an article in the West Briton, dated the 20th of October, 1837, which reads, "A great sea serpent. One of those great sea serpents, probably some relation to that seen lately at Storfosen and the Kregisang Islands, called a conger, was brought into Mevagissey last week by a fisherman named John Hicks, which weighed 95 pounds. It is supposed to be the largest ever brought in there." So, in this instance, it seems there's very little dispute as to what this creature is, and they're quite certain this is basically a type of eel. As to the Storfosen and Kregisang Islands they're referring to, I haven't been able to identify as yet the islands that they're talking about. But they seem to be comparing this creature with a recent sighting of a similar creature elsewhere. So this one seems relatively cut and dry. There's a general consensus that on this occasion, it's some kind of eel. I want to jump forward a little bit in time now to 1876 and an encounter involving two fishermen from Port Scatho. Recently, I chatted with Elizabeth Dale, aka the Cornish Bird, who's written articles on Cornwall's Leviathans and the stories of Morgor, gathering together a number of sources and accounts from across the centuries. So we began chatting about these monster stories from across Cornwall, what makes them so interesting and intriguing, and we began by chatting about this fairly early account.
The first one that I came across in relation to Cornwall was this story at Port Scatho on the Roseland. And that was like in the 1870s, 1876, I think. It appeared in the Royal Cornwall Gazette. And it was this story of these fishermen who had spotted this serpentine creature out in the bay off Port Scatho. And they went over to investigate. But the thing that I really liked about the article was it kind of gave this creature character, because it said that when the fishermen came near, that this creature lifted up its head and showed signs of defiance, which I thought was great. And then it doesn't end well, because the fishermen, they catch this creature, they kill it, and then they bring it into harbour. But by the time the reporter gets there from the newspaper, they've thrown it into the sea. But yeah, that was the first story I came across quite early on.
Let's look a bit further then into this story from Port Scatho. We're told that in April of 1876, two fishermen were returning to Port Scatho when they encountered this serpentine creature. The article in the Royal Cornwall Gazette reads, "Port Scatho, the sea serpent. Our correspondent, Mr. Basisto, writes, the sea serpent was caught alive in Gerrans Bay on the 26th. Two of our fishermen were afloat overhauling their crab pots, about 400 or 500 yards from the shore, when they discovered a serpent coiled about the floating cork mark of the crab pot below. Upon their near approach, it lifted its head and showed signs of defiance, upon which they struck it forcibly with an oar. so far disabled it as to allow them to proceed with their work, after which they observed the serpent floating about near the boat. They pursued and captured it, bringing it ashore yet alive for exhibition, soon after which it was killed on the rocks and most inconsiderately cast again into the sea. So, while the author clearly laments that the creature hadn't been left out on public display, you get the impression that the locals were, frankly, a bit freaked out by it and wanted nothing to do with it.
It says something. Some of these are real insight into the mentality of the time, that it showed signs of defiance, so they kind of whacked it with an oar.
Yeah.
Yeah. It didn't look too happy, so we gave
exactly.
It a whack.
Exactly. So, yeah, they weren't like, you know, trying to make some kind of scientific discovery. They just, you know, yeah, as you say, knocked it over the head. One of the things that has kept my interest, I suppose, in this, because it's very easy to dismiss these stories as, you know, a bit bonkers. But the thing that has kept my interest in it is a lot of the accounts are from mariners and fishermen. So not just random people like myself standing on the seashore and seeing something that I don't understand or recognize, but from men whose sea is their home. You know, this is what they know, this is what they understand, and they are very familiar with the creatures that are supposed to be in the sea. So I find it's very difficult to dismiss the stories out of hand when you've got accounts from so many different fishermen and sailors and mariners. So that's what I think keeps my interest, in a way, is that it's not so easy to just poo-poo these men and go, oh yeah, well they've obviously just seen a porpoise, you know. It has to be something in my head. There has to be a little something more to it than that.
A couple of early examples there then from the south coast. But I want to head northeast now to Bude, where just a few years later, on the 12th of October 1883, the Reverend E. Highton, Vicar of Bude, wrote to the Times to report, and I quote, "Yesterday afternoon, about 4:30, a remarkable sight was seen from Summerlays, an open down at Bude, overlooking the sea. I saw a long, low, dark object, about a mile and a half from the shore, skimming along the surface of the sea. The back of the creature being a little above the top of the water. It kept on its course at a rate which I calculated to be at about 25 miles an hour, never once disappearing entirely. It was watched by several friends who were with me and myself for about 10 minutes, and by that time it had passed over a considerable space of water, between 4 and 5 miles, I should think. The creature's length was variously guessed by us to be from 50 to 80 feet. Just once, a larger mass appeared out of the water than at any other time, and then not for more than a couple of seconds. This was at the end, apparently, of the creature, but it scarcely looked like a tail. It seemed more like a curl in some long, thin monster." End quote. He then appeals to any scientific readers who might be able to identify what it was. And this is the case with many sightings throughout the Victorian period. You get an account in the papers, and then it's sort of opened out to the scientific community to present their thoughts and theories as to what the creature might be. There's a real desire to classify and identify these unknown creatures. There's lots of thoughts and theories as to why there's this sudden surge in accounts and sightings from across the globe, and why people were suddenly so interested. In 2019, Dr. Charles Paxton, School of Mathematics and Statistics at University of St Andrews, and Dr. Darren Naish, paleontologist at University of Southampton, teamed up to find trends within reports of sea monsters from 1801 up to 2015. looking into the idea that the 19th century reports of sea monsters and sea serpents were influenced by the discovery of ancient reptile fossils. Dr. Paxton wrote, "The discovery of long-necked marine reptile fossils in the 19th century does appear to have had an influence on what people believe they have spotted in the water. It's an interesting theory that the discovery and growing interest in dinosaurs might have had an impact. It also seems that there's a couple of particular accounts that are pointed to as being the real catalysts, if you like, for this surge in interest in what's often called in newspapers at the time as the Great Sea Serpent. One is the Gloucester Sea Serpent, sighted off Massachusetts and Cape Ann in 1817, and another is a report made by Captain Peter McQuay of the HMS Daedalus, sailing off the Cape of Good Hope on a voyage back from the East Indies in August of 1848. In a letter to the Illustrated London News, he describes a creature as it comes in close proximity to their vessel. On our attention being called to the object, it was discovered to be an enormous serpent, with head and shoulders kept about 4 feet constantly above the surface of the sea, and as nearly as we could approximate, by comparing with the length of what our main topsail yard would show in the water, there was at the very least 60 feet of the animal à fleur d'eau, meaning at the water's edge, no portion of which was, to our perception, used in propelling it through the water, either by vertical or horizontal undulation. So, this creature seems to have passed very close to them, and very rapidly. McQuay goes on to say, "The diameter of the serpent was about 15 or 16 inches behind the head, which was, without any doubt, that of a snake, and it was never, during the 20 minutes that it continued in sight of our glasses, once below the surface of the water. Its colour, a dark brown, with yellowish white about the throat. It had no fins, but something like the mane of a horse, or rather a bunch of seaweed washed about its back. It was seen by the quartermaster, the boatswain's mate, and the man at the wheel, in addition to myself and officers above mentioned." Captain McQuay seems to have been regarded as a man of good reputation, upstanding and of good character, and it's a very detailed and articulate account. It's very swiftly followed by people writing in response to McQuay's report, some of them mariners such as James Henderson, master of the Mary Ann of Glasgow, who are recounting their own sightings of a serpent with a dragon's head. Then you start to get people debating and basically arguing with each other. There's in fact a letter from a reader to the editor of the Royal Cornwall Gazette that begins, and I quote, "I observe in your paper of last week that you treat the account of the Great Sea Serpent, lately reported by Captain McQuay, Royal Navy, with a contempt that I think it does not deserve." So you can see how impassioned people are getting about this. They go on to write, "I am not about to say that I am a believer in the Great Sea Serpent, but I think the evidence is sufficiently strong to arrest our attention, and to show that some huge, undescribed creature has yet eluded our researches and has been seen by the captain of the Daedalus." End quote. Now, I didn't want to get too far off topic, but I wanted to mention the Daedalus because it really seems to kick off a lot of the discussion and debate about sea serpents for decades afterwards. And as shown there, even readers in Cornwall are getting involved in the discussion. I also think it leads in nicely to a sighting a number of years later, at the turn of the 20th century, from the far west of Cornwall, off Land's End. In a London paper called the Daily News, dated the 21st of September 1903, there's an article that reads as follows. "A snake-like monster of huge proportions and quite 100 feet in length has, it is alleged, been seen by the crew of the Falmouth tug Triton in the vicinity of the longships. When sighted, it was travelling very fast near the steamer, the occupants of which were naturally much alarmed. The men say that they never before saw anything like it, or anything of so horrible and forbidding an aspect. Its head was abnormally large, with tremendous tusks or fins. It sheered away from the tug and went off at a high rate of speed, diving under the water at short intervals. This story sparked immediate reactions. For example, in a written response in the Cornish Echo to this sighting by the Triton, the author begins by saying that they've known and respected the skipper, Captain White, for years, but, and I quote, "Now I fear when he comes ashore with some thrilling story of his adventures at sea, his yarn about the sea serpent will rise up before me and weaken my credulity." End quote.
That one seemed to get a lot of criticism or like responses from people who were sort of almost going, "I know that captain or that skipper. He should almost know better." And there's quite a lot of almost the sort of things that you'd expect on Twitter, now X or whatever, of like arguments through the newspaper of going, "Oh, you know, what are they doing? Why, how could they sink so low as to report, you know, sea serpent thing?"
Yeah, well, that goes back away in what I was trying to say about the fishermen in a way, wasn't it? You know, that I think it's Captain White that was on the Triton. He was a very experienced seaman. He'd been sailing in the waters in Falmouth and around the Isles of Scilly for 30-odd years. And he comes back with this story about, you know, a sea serpent 30 metres long that he's seen out in the water. And as you say, you know, he's a respected man within his community. So he must have seen something important, you know, that he felt was important, that he wasn't just spinning a yarn. Mm. You know, it's his reputation, isn't it, that's on the line in a way. And, you know, to come back and tell this, what people are saying is, you know, like a tall tale, I don't think that he would have done that lightly. And the same with the fishermen, you know, I really don't feel that any of them were making it up. Maybe they were mistaken in what they saw, but I don't feel that any of them were just spinning a yarn, you know, because they, as you say, not everyone believed them, and they were open to, you know, a certain amount of criticism.
I think it's interesting in a way that they almost start by pointing out their experience, and you kind of think, well, in that case, does that not lend merit to what they're stating to an extent? Because you go, if they are that experienced, they know that route, they know those waters, they've been doing it for years, does that not mean that they're going to know there's something irregular there? And probably, I imagine, I can't remember offhand without having it here, how many other people were on board that also saw it?
Mm. You know, these are men of the sea. They have spent hundreds or thousands of hours bobbing around in these oceans, and especially the fishermen pulling up all these different catches. You know, they will have seen fish and sea creatures that you and me would not be familiar with at all, but it would have been part of their almost daily lives. So, you know, for them to come out and say that they've seen something really peculiar, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that you have to have a certain amount of weight to that idea. Yeah, for sure.
Just a couple of years after the sighting by the Triton, a Mr. E.S. Dodgson of Jesus College, Oxford, wrote a letter to the Western Morning News dated the 12th of September 1907. And I quote, "At 11:45 a.m. today, I was seated with Reverend T.C. Davies, M.A., Queen's College, Oxford, chaplain of an almshouse at Sheffield, who is now staying in this hotel, on the edge of the cliff of the cove known as Gullestam, at Tintagel, when he called my attention to a black object that was moving at a distance of about 200 yards, very rapidly, along the calm surface of the sea, towards Tintagel Head. In about a minute, it had disappeared behind the cliff that bounds the cove on the west. It was a sea serpent, at least 20 feet long, holding its large head with apparently some kind of a crest or mane upon it aloft. Unfortunately, we had no telescope with us, still less a Kodak wherewith to take its likeness. We are told that no such beast is known to have been seen here. End quote. A week later, there's a response to this sighting, which is given in the Aberdeen Journal, dated the 19th of September. Experts believe that the sea serpent, seen off Tintagel, North Cornwall, was one of the ribbon fishes, Regalacus, of which 25 specimens have been secured on the British coasts. The animal, known as the oarfish, or king of the herrings, is delicate in structure and quite inoffensive. Probably accident or disease had brought it to the surface. So, some interesting thoughts and observations being presented there as to what the creature might have been. Our next case comes nearly two decades later, in May of 1926, when two fishermen from Flushing, Mr. B. Rees and Mr. B. Gilbert, were out trawling 3 miles south of Falmouth Harbour.
Yeah, May 1926, and it was two fishermen, you know, old school boys out fishing one day, and they were pulling up their net, and it was much, much heavier than it should be, and they assumed that they had snagged something or, you know, caught something unexpected, but I don't think they were quite expecting what they dragged onto their boat.
So, in terms of this creature that they hauled in, it's described in the Western Morning News as such. The animal had a tail quite 8 feet, and a beak about 2 feet long and 6 inches wide. It had four legs connected to the body with armour-like joints and covered in thick scales. The monster had a wide, flat back covered with matted brown hair.
Disturbing, you know what I mean? It's not a pretty creature that they are describing. And what intrigued me about this one is that these guys had real close contact with this creature. It isn't something that they've seen out in the water, away from them, and they only see it for a split second before it disappears beneath the waves. They dragged this creature from their net onto their boat, you know, so they had real close contact with it. And they describe it as having a beak, which is like 2 foot long, and it's got legs covered in scales, and it's got a body that's covered in matted brown fur, and a long, thick tail as well. And it's on their boat for a few minutes. They're panicking, clearly, not knowing what to do with it. And then it just starts thrashing around and throws itself back over the side of the boat. But if I remember rightly, didn't they have like samples, or they had a piece of the fur or something was left? So yeah, I always found that a bit weird, like an unexplained story. You've got two fishermen who are pulling up a creature that they don't recognize or understand, and they've had real close contact with it for an extended period of time. And, you know, it scared the bejesus out of them.
And I think you're right. I think they got, I've forgotten the name of the organization in Plymouth, to try and analyze or to go like, along with their description, to try and identify it. And I think they came up dry. They couldn't come up with an explanation. But yeah, I think you're right. I seem to remember that maybe there was blood left, because I don't know if it had been injured in the hauling it in.
Like Plymouth Marine Society or something like that.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's something very disconcerting about that one. I think it's added to by the concept of fur, because you don't associate fur on aquatic creatures.
No, I agree with you. Yeah, there's something about that description of the matted fur on its body that just makes you cringe a little bit. Yeah. And it's sort of, if you try and picture what they're describing, you know, this long beak, these scaly legs, you know, this matted fur, this does not sound like something you want in your little boat with you.
No. I have to wonder at the size and the scale of that one, because obviously somehow they were able to haul it in and then it seems to have escaped
over the side or something.
Yeah. So I'm unclear, and I'm not even sure if it says in the accounts other than the size of the beacon things, like the size of it compared to, because some of them are described as like 100 feet and you're like, well, that's surely, you know, that's not going to fit on a boat. But I'm not sure on that one how big it was supposed to have been.
It does say in the description actually that the creature was 20 feet long, with a 2-foot beak and an 8-foot tail. But whether that's inclusive in the 20 feet, if you know what I mean, or if you know we're adding the tail on, I'm not really sure. But yeah, roughly 20 feet, so 6 meters, in length, you know, which is fairly hefty.
Yeah.
I don't know about the whole hauling it on board, whether they had any kind of mechanism for doing that, but still fairly freaky, I'd say.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of the visual representation that one conjures up is slightly different to some of the others you hear about, I think, compared to the later ones that are much more plesiosaur like. This feels like something slightly different.
Slightly different. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the ones of the Morgor and the Helfand River or the Falmouth Bay area, that side of the Falmouth Bay, anyway, in the 1970s, they're all fairly similar, aren't they? You know, all describing this long neck. Some of them say it's got a little horn, but, you know, they're all fairly similar to each other. But yeah, this one is a bit of an outlier. It's a bit of a weird one.
An interesting case, that one, with a very different kind of creature by the sounds of it, and up close as well. For reference, it was the Plymouth Marine Biological Observatory that we're told did an analysis at the time, working on the description that was given, and authorities were unable to identify the creature. We mentioned briefly the stories about Morgor in the 1970s, and we'll be coming on to that in just a moment, as that really warrants further discussion. But first off, because we've kind of been working our way through chronologically so far, there's another case that I came across recently in the course of my research that comes again from Mevagissey in an account by a chap called Ed Boddart back in 1944, when he was 13 years old. You can actually find a copy of it on one of the Mevagissey website, and I'll pop a link to it in the show notes. Essentially, one night, Ed is out on a vessel called the Ibis, fishing for pilchards, along with the three Lakeman brothers who own the vessel, and a chap called Percy Hunkin. And the main account reads as follows. The Black Sea parted, some 10 to 12 feet in front of Percy's face, off the starboard side. A 3 to 4 foot diameter object, with a ball-like head, came straight out of the water and rose to a height of some 12 feet above the water's surface. The deck that I was standing on was 4 feet off the water. I was about 5.5 feet and was looking slightly up at it. "Corell!" exclaimed Percy, as he reeled back from the rail, throwing his hands in front of his face. "What is it?" I looked back at the others by the wheelhouse. They were staring at this thing with their mouths open. That vision still remains with me. Three seasoned seamen staring at this thing with their mouths open. I turned to look at this thing, momentarily poised on the sea. It gave a breathing sound before slipping vertically down the way it had come. A stunned silence for a few seconds before excited conversation broke out as the four fishermen compared sightings. A tubular form with globular head seen from the bow and the stern. Not a whale, nor a submarine periscope or snorkel. Whatever it was, they had never seen nor read about anything like this. I remained holding on to the foremast, feeling cold, clammy, and decidedly scared. I do not remember what we did after that. I think the idea of looking for more pilchard was abandoned, and we returned to harbour. Another interesting little story there. And one of the things I find fascinating about this that links in with some of the things that Liz was saying earlier is the level of experience of these men. Earlier in the account, these fishermen are teaching things to Ed, passing on their knowledge and seamanship, and at one point, in fact, there's a whale sighting. So all clearly know the typical creatures that you'd encounter on such a voyage and how to identify them. But this was something none of them could identify or explain. At the end of the article, he writes that 12 years later, in 1956, he was back in Mevagissey on a holiday with his wife, and he paid a visit to the crew of the Ibis. In passing, he said to Eddie Lakeman, "By the way, did you ever see anything of that thing we saw off Foy Point in 1944? To which Eddie shouted up to the other fisherman on the quay, "There you are, he remembers it after all this time. And you didn't believe us." We're jumping forward now to the 1970s and the moment you've all been waiting for. I want to take a look at the stories and accounts that seem to begin in the mid-70s on the south coast of Cornwall, surrounding a creature that's come to be known over the years as Morgor or Morgar, which means sea giant.
How do you pronounce it?
I say Morgor. Is that not right?
I've no idea. I don't know if it's Morgor, Morgar, Morgower.
I mean, I don't know for sure at all, but I've always said Morgor, so I don't know. For the purposes of this podcast, we will be using the pronunciation Morgor.
there we go. There's so many within a certain time frame from different places, but within a sort of 2-3 year period, quite a lot of sightings, which is quite, I don't know what you'd call it, but that's unusual. But to have so many sightings within like a couple of year period.
Yeah. In sort of a confined area as well. Well, I suppose the first one that I came across was 1975. And there was a couple of people that were standing up on Pendennis Point, looking out at Falmouth Bay, and they saw this creature come up out of the water with a conger eel in its mouth. And what I found interesting about that one is a lot of the sort of skeptics' explanation is, oh, it's just a giant eel. Well, these people saw a creature that was catching a conger eel. So it's kind of like the impression that you get is that this is a creature that is much bigger than your average eel out there. And they described it as a hideous, humped creature. With a bristly neck and two little stumped horns sticking out the top of its head. And I don't know how widely this was reported, but just a few months later, you get this letter to the Falmouth Packet, which I've always wanted to know the person that wrote it, because they wanted to be kept anonymous, and they're just in the paper, I think, as Mary or Mary F. And they send this letter to the Falmouth Packet along with a couple of very grainy photographs of what looks like, I don't know, very dark shape out in the water, but with quite an obvious long curving neck. And the lady says in the letter that they were standing on Trefusis Point, which is just sort of opposite in a way Pendennis Point. And they saw this creature out in the water. They watched it for several minutes. They had a camera with them and managed to take a couple of pictures. Obviously, they would have been quite a distance away, though, I assume, which is why the photographs are so sort of poor and grainy. And obviously, they probably just had a regular camera as well. They didn't have like any kind of, you know, telescopic lens like, you know, we would have nowadays. And they described that, you know, they were actually really quite frightened by what they saw, which I think is another kind of telling point to me as well, is that people are seeing something that genuinely frightens and disturbs them.
Looking a little bit closer at this account and the story behind these famous photos, the original letter that accompanied the images was published in the Falmouth Packet on the 5th of March 1976, and it reads as follows. The enclosed photos were taken by me about 3 weeks ago from Trefusis. They show one of the large sea creatures mentioned in your paper recently. I am glad to know that other people have seen the sea serpent. The pictures are not very clear because of the sun shining right into the camera and the haze on the water. Also, I took them very quickly indeed. The animal was only up for a few seconds. I would say it was about 15 to 18 foot long. I mean the part showing above the water. It looked like an elephant waving its trunk, but the trunk was a long neck with a small head at the end like a snake's head. It had humps on its back which moved in a funny way. The colour was black or very dark brown, and the skin seemed to be like a sea lion's. My brother developed the film. I didn't want to take it to the chemist. Perhaps you can make them clearer. As a matter of fact, the animal frightened me. I would not like to see it any closer. I do not like the way it moved when swimming. You can put these pictures in the paper, a few like. I don't want payment, and I don't want any name in the paper about this. I just think you should tell people about this animal. What is it? Yours sincerely, Mary F., Falmouth.
Now, you could argue in a way that once it hit the newspapers, that it created its own kind of frenzy around it, I suppose. But from then on, all through like the late 70s, I think into the early 80s as well, you get these sightings of this creature. And the Helford River and the Falmouth Bay became known as the Morgor Mile.
One example from around this time of a pretty close encounter with the creature comes from a couple of months after the Mary F. photos in July of 1976, when George Vinicombe and his mate John Cock set off from Falmouth. According to George, it was a beautiful day, clear, calm, nothing on the water.
They saw what they thought was a capsized boat. So, you know, being good seamen, they thought they'd better go over and investigate what it was. And as they got nearer, they realised it wasn't a capsized boat because this head on a long neck came up out of the water. The Natural History Museum, a representative, someone came down from the museum to see these guys and interviewed them, like images of different sea creatures. And the one that they identified, and they both individually identified the same creature, and I'm probably not going to pronounce it right, but I think it's a pelleosaur. Is that right? I don't know. But it's a dinosaur that supposedly has been extinct for millions of years. And this was what these two fishermen said that they had seen.
When he was interviewed, John Cock said, "We've seen whales and we've seen dolphins and all that sort of thing, but this was nothing like that at all. It was like a prehistoric monster." George went on to say, "There's no doubt about it. It was something different to what I'd ever seen before, and larger than I'd seen before. We'd a 32-foot boat, and it was as big as a boat."
I always find going back to like the early, like that first sighting in 1975 intrigues me, because it comes literally, you know, out of the blue. And you've got nothing to compare it by for like decades or whatever ever since. And again, you get that sense they're generally frightened. But there's that illustration I think you've included in your blog article of like the long-necked humped creature with an eel. Again, it gives you a sense of perspective, but it is Loch Ness monster-like. But yeah, again, I think, yeah, there is something in that sense of when we don't understand something, we do tend to react with a sort of fear. And I think maybe it's just something instinctive in us to kind of go, "I don't like it because I don't understand it."
I don't know what that is. Therefore, my reaction must be to run away.
But also have a camera if I can, you know. But
well, these days everyone would have their smartphone on them, because that's the other thing. Looking back now, in the 1970s, people weren't walking around with a camera in their pocket. A lot of these accounts are just literally people reporting what they've seen. Which to us now, we're like, oh, well, you know, we want to see video evidence, we want to see photographic evidence, but that just wasn't a thing. Although you do get a few accounts where I think there was the editor of like Cornish Life magazine who claimed to have seen this creature in the Helford River off Parsons Beach. And he had a camera with him, but he claimed that the camera stuck. It stopped working when he tried to take pictures of what he was seeing, which makes me a little bit like suspicious. There was a little bit of, I don't know, a bit of a frenzy around this sea creature or this sea monster in during that period. And there was a certain amount of jumping on the bandwagon, I think, with it, especially guy Doc Shields. He got involved in it as well, and he's the one that famously promoted sort of the Owl Man of Morgan, and then again, you know, this was his territory, his stomping ground on the Helford, and he claimed to be able to psychically communicate with the Morgor, and be able to sort of draw it out of the water or something. So yeah, there was a certain amount of jumping on the bandwagon, but the majority of the accounts that I picked up on through that period do seem to be genuine. I mean, there's that one in September 1976, there was a guy, Donald Ferris, and he was walking on Gilly Beach with his dog. And he says to the West Briton that he thought that the whole thing was rubbish. He'd been laughing at, you know, the accounts of this sea monster that people had claimed to be seeing. And then he was walking his dog on the beach and saw what he described as a 60-foot long, I mean, that's huge, sea creature out in the water. So, yeah, so although you've got a certain amount of you know, people just really enjoying the hype, there are enough sort of credible accounts to make me wonder.
So let's take a look at a couple of other sightings. There's one which took place on Good Friday of 1976, when a schoolboy from Helston saw a weird animal with two humps and a long neck like a snake near Toll Point at the mouth of the Helford River. Apparently, he took some photos, which were sent in and shown on the local news, but I haven't found any more on that. Then in May that same year, two London bankers, Tony Rogers and John Chambers, were interviewed by the Falmouth Packet. They said they'd been fishing off the rocks at Parsons Beach at Mornin when, and I quote, "Suddenly, something rose out of the water, about 150 or 200 yards away. It was greeny-grey in colour and appeared to have humps. Another smaller one also appeared. They were visible for about 10 seconds and looked straight at us," end quote. In From Granite to Sea, Alex Langstone writes that in the summer of 1976, Carol Marshall and her son Guy witnessed a sea serpent from the balcony of their home at Downderry. So this is over in southeast Cornwall. She said, "It was a great big long thing, like a snake. It came right into the beach." Apparently, they watched the creature for 2 or 3 minutes and reported, "It really shifted, and it didn't leave any wake. It was described as just black and looked similar to pictures of the Loch Ness Monster." A year later, over the weekend of the 9th and 10th of July 1977, Len Yates, a Caradon district councillor, along with his wife and a friend, witnessed a strange creature skimming the surface of the sea. So there does seem to have been a real collection of sightings from off the south coast of Cornwall, seeing something of a boom within that period of a couple of years in the mid to late 1970s.
Yeah, you do get a sense with some of these, like the sort of the two London bankers who were interviewed. And I don't know, there's parts of me that kind of wonders at what point, because there have been so many articles on it over so many successive months, if you send in a Morgul sighting that you're like, well, you're guaranteed to get, you know, coverage.
Your name in the paper.
Yeah, potentially. I don't know, because it feels like the 70s in particular seems like a real heyday for like Nessie sightings. And I feel like a load of the books I found in the library as a kid that were on monsters and UFOs and ghosts were like those Osborne.
Written in the 70s.
Yeah, so there's a real interest in it and sort of scientists, if you like.
In inverted commas, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess, but understandably also trying to understand what's going on behind this, but there does seem to be a real sort of monster fever, if you like, in the 70s in particular.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But I mean, I think that it still holds a certain amount of fascination for people right up until the modern day. I mean, they just had in Loch Ness, I don't know if you heard this, but they've had the biggest investigation in decades about a month ago at Loch Ness, where there were literally hundreds of scientists out on the water with various bits of high-tech equipment looking for Nessie. Mm. And, you know, she is the most famous of our sea monsters, but, you know, and there is still such a curiosity about that. Even though for however long this story has been going, there has never really been any concrete proof of anything. No. But we are still fascinated by that story about, you know, that mystery about what could be lurking out there in the water. So I think it's the same with the Morgul. When I published the article on my blog, I got loads of response from people, you know, and various people claiming to have seen something weird. And as I keep saying, for me, if there's that amount of people over this amount of time that are all seeing something that they can't explain, that there has to be something to it. I don't know what that is, whether it is a giant eel of some description. I don't know. But I love it. I think it's great fun.
There definitely seems a continued interest in the idea of sea monsters and sea serpents in general, and in the stories and sightings of Morgul. Even though the bulk of accounts seem to date from that period in the 1970s, occasional sightings seem to have continued. In 1996, writer Sheila Bird's account, along with George Venicum's, in fact, appeared in an episode of the ITV series Strange But True. In it, she recounted that in 1985, she and her brother were walking on the clifftop above Port Scatho when they spotted something out at sea. She said, and I quote, "There was this gigantic sea creature with a small head, a long neck, and an enormous hump." She went on to say, "It was swan-like."
Going back to the Morgul, the witch from Scotland, did you read about her?
No, what's this one?
So she was I think her name was Psyche. So she was a Scottish witch who claimed to have a connection with Nessie. And so when all these sightings of the Morgul and the Helford were coming up, she was in the newspapers that she was going to come down to Cornwall and she was going to communicate with Morgul. And she came down here, and her witchy friends started bathing naked in the river to lure the sea monster out. I'm not quite sure how those two things connect. but yeah, apparently that was a thing for a while, this Scottish witch bathing naked in the Helford River.
Wow. Okay. I wonder if as a result they had a whole different sort of series of sightings of.
I feel like there was a certain amount of not taking it all too seriously as well, because the local schools in the sort of the Falmouth area had a costume competition where the school children made sea monster costumes and had some kind of, you know, parade in their sea monster costumes, which I think is brilliant.
My inner 8-year-old is going, that sounds amazing. But I can imagine parents going, oh God, am I going to do this out of cardboard loo roll holders? You know.
Yeah, and Kellogg's Rice Krispies boxes.
But I didn't know if there were any more, or if you've come across any more in recent years, similar sightings or reports of any.
No, I'm wondering if it was Sheila Bird that wrote about the, no, I'm not sure that it was now. Hang on a minute. There's a lady called Jill Newton who wrote a book about the Helford River in the 1970s again. So 1979, actually. And she spoke to a man called Rex Hoskins. Mm-hmm. And his family had, I'm not sure if this family is still there, but do you know Gear Farm? Have you heard of Gear Farm, where they
Yes.
do the most amazing pasties in Cornwall? Anyway.
Okay.
The Hoskins family had been at Gear Farm for like generations, and Rex Hoskins, who she spoke to in 1979, when he was a little boy, so like the 1940s, he told her about a sighting that he had had, and he'd been down on the riverside, the Helford River, fishing or swimming or something like that. And he had seen this creature coming up out of the water with a humped back. And he ran home and told his family what he had seen. And they completely dismissed him and like basically just laughed at him. But he remembered that for the rest of his life. So when he was talking to Jill Newton, you know, he was probably quite an elderly man at that point. And he remembered that sighting. But yeah, interesting.
That's interesting, because I love things like that, because that's when I'd not encountered it, and it doesn't sort of crop up in your usual almost timeline of Cornish kind of sightings. It's not one that's sort of in the
it's out in the middle of nowhere, isn't it? So it's not one of the early ones, it's not one of the 1970s ones, it's like somewhere in the middle. And the book, Jill Newton's book, is not like anything about the supernatural, or, you know, it's a very much a book about the Helford River, you know, the history of it and the geology and, you know, nature and things like that. And then you've got this strange little story just shoved in there that she obviously thought, well, that's interesting, you know, and it's not one that I've heard anywhere else either.
We've talked then about a number of accounts and sightings attributed to Morgor, or a similar type creature. And even now, if you were to Google it, you'll find tons of websites recounting the various stories and people presenting their theories, whether they lean towards the side of the believer or the skeptic. And a lot of focus is geared towards those grainy photos attributed to this person known as Mary F. Some people are convinced by them, and others dismiss them outright. There was even an article written in the Somerset County Gazette in 2001 where the writer claims that the original image was that of a model created by students at the Falmouth College of Art at that time. To be honest, who knows? I think it's interesting that it still provokes discussion and debate. And I like the idea that in Cornwall, we have our own stories to tell. And I suppose I'm intrigued by the possibility that there might be an unknown creature out there somewhere. We've explored a range of stories then from across Cornwall over the last couple of centuries, some of them famous, others perhaps more obscure, that have amazed, provoked discussion and debate. And that debate still rages on, as people continue to present their theories as to what these creatures could be.
Why are these sort of stories of sea serpents and sea creatures still, why do they continue to fascinate us? Because I'm thinking, I always think back to being a kid and taking those books out of the library that had the sort of Mary F photos and the sort of Loch Ness photos. And as a kid, those are the things you first get drawn to because they're visual, very striking things. And then you sort of like learn more as you're reading. But what kind of, what fascinates you about these sort of, these sightings and these accounts and these stories? And why do you think they still fascinate so many people?
What fascinates me, I guess, is the unexplained, I suppose. I love a good mystery. So I'm attracted to that kind of story. There's also that element of not being able to distinguish what's real and what's fantasy. So I want to believe these stories that these people are telling. I really, I want them to be true. And like I said before, I believe that a lot of these people 100% were telling you what they thought they had seen. And so there's something exciting about that, that the idea that there could be something lurking out there in the water that we haven't discovered yet, because as humans we have a tendency, as a society I suppose, not on an individual level, but we have a tendency to think that we are in control and we know it all and it's all been explained. And so when there's the element of the mysterious out there, I think that's what attracts people to it, what resonates with people. And I think the idea that the ocean is just so vast and there are huge pockets of it that haven't been thoroughly explored or explored at all. And who are we to say that there isn't something out there that hasn't been discovered yet? You know, these cameras that go down into the darkest depths of the ocean and come across these glowing fish, and just the most bizarre creatures that you wouldn't ever imagine could possibly be real, and they are real. So yeah, I love that idea of there being our own Cornish Nessie out there, just lurking in the waters of Falmouth Bay, sniggering because we haven't caught her yet.
That's it for this episode. I hope you've enjoyed that little exploration of some of the accounts and stories of sea monsters from across Cornwall over the centuries. A massive thank you to the brilliant Elizabeth Dale for taking the time to chat all things sea monstery. And I highly recommend checking out her blog articles exploring the story of Cornwall's leviathans and the story of Morgor. I'll pop links to both of those in the show notes. The Pisky Trap is written and presented by me, Keith Wallace, with music by Elizabeth Westcott and artwork by Karis Harrington. We'll be back again very soon to explore a very different topic and an exciting new collaboration. Thanks for listening.